Hello again, everyone. It's me, Jerry T. T for toast, as in dry toast, shaken, not stirred. So, hello, everybody, and welcome. I've got a returning guest today, Dr. Mikolaj Rajic. We spoke last year about COVID, and then we spoke about the company Merogenomics. So in a minute, I'm going to let Dr. Rajic introduce himself. But first, hope you enjoyed the last section, the last episode, my first one on climate change, which will end up being two or three episodes. It's looking more and more like it'll probably be three. Second episode coming up shortly. But there's so much to research on climate science, and it's like every day it's changing. There's something new coming out every day, so it's getting longer and longer. But we'll wrap it up for sure in three episodes. So that's coming next. But today we're going to do an update on COVID. And so welcome back, Dr. Rajic. And why don't you take a minute, tell the folks about yourself, about your company, Merogenomics.
Thank you for having me back. And my name is Dr. Mikolaj Rajic. My background is I have a doctorate degree in biochemistry and undergrad in genetics. My passion is genetics. Biochemistry simply enhanced my molecular biology in sciences. And I'm very grateful for that because if there is one thing I can say definitively, what I took out of all of my years of going to university, blah, 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 it's the ability to read science papers and be able to study them and gain insights rapidly, which your average person will not be doing because your average person will not have the appetite to go through such a dry toast information.
Well played.
However, I personally really enjoy reading science papers. Because I can get through it rapidly, and I always see science as ever-changing story. And you're mentioning how the climate change science is continuously changing or evolving, and in my head I was thinking, well, of course it is. It's science. Science typically always changes. It takes a lot of irrefutable evidence before anything can be called a dogma. And otherwise, unless it becomes a dogma because you collected decades of supporting information, you should always assume that scientific information that is presented to you could be incorrect. That's how science should work. So anyway, my background, right? So my background, my doctorate degree was linked to immunology. I was looking for novel immunosuppressive compounds. So I've been looking at the world of immunology for quite some time. It is very complicated world. It's like the way I see it is like it's like going into astronomy. It's in like feels like a never-ending field. And of course, in the last few years, because of the pandemic, I've started studying that area in much, much greater detail. And of course, I also put out my Merogenomics YouTube channel, which now almost completely focuses on molecular biology of COVID and the vaccines. And vaccines, I was very interested in that topic because of the new technology, mRNA technology. And being in genetics and dealing with genetic diseases, obviously, I'm very hopeful that this technology, once we perfect it, we'll be able to use it one day successfully to treat some of these conditions.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dr. Rajic. And so, yes, you make sure, and we'll put links in the show notes to your company, and we'll also put links into your YouTube channel because it's always very interesting. And even if the topic isn't interesting, which it always is, they can always have fun like I do trying to figure out where you are because you're always in different places. And some pretty very, very nice-looking places in the mountains, in the forest, in different countries. So there you go. So there's a little introduction. So, okay, let's now dig into our COVID follow-up episode here. And I wanted to start with this concept of immune escape. And apparently COVID is exhibiting this immune escape. And there's two theories that are considered, one considered likely, one considered unlikely. So why don't we talk about, I guess, the one that's considered unlikely first. Let's talk a bit about that. And then, the cause, the most unlikely cause. And then we'll talk about the likely cause. How does that sound?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. So, yeah. So let's tell us a bit about immune escape, what it is, and then discuss the two, start with the most unlikely cause or the generally accepted unlikely cause and then the likely cause.
Okay, so then when we talk about immune escape, we're talking about the evolution of the virus. And in this case, of course, we're talking about SARS-CoV-2 virus, the virus that caused the COVID-19 pandemic. So if we're talking about that the virus has gone through the immune escape process, it means that the virus has assembled mutations which then subsequently were selected to dominate. And these mutations allow the virus to have a different three-dimensional, say, image or basically shape that now allows that virus to no longer be as effortlessly or efficiently processed by immune system from a variety of, say, different angles. Because when I say immune system, it's a very broad umbrella word. But then let's just say immune system, normally its goal is supposed to be to reduce the negative impacts of the virus. And now virus has managed to basically dodge our immune system, and therefore it can more effortlessly infect us. And indeed, over the time of this pandemic, the virus has been becoming more and more infectious. So that's what that means by the immune escape.
Okay. And now this is not a new phenomenon. Like, viruses regularly evolve or is this a new phenomenon? It's been seen before, correct?
Yes, it's been seen before, but it's not very broadly studied topic because actually it is not commonly observed. Why? Because when we're talking about immune escape, we're talking about evolution of the virus. Now, the virus always evolves because, and that's any organism. So then if you allow yourself to think that virus is like a living organism, there's arguments whether you can call it living organism or not, because it needs a host to survive. For sake of simplicity, I'll just call it like an organism that can obviously replicate. It can do that. So any organism that can replicate will always introduce mutations in the process of replication of its genetic material. That happens with us, with humans as well. As a consequence, every single one of us who is born, we always have our own unique mutations that we never inherited from our parents. It's just what happens. When you duplicate genetic code, the machinery that duplicates the genetic code is not perfect and will introduce mutations. It's designed like that by Mother Nature on purpose because we want evolution. Why we want evolution and these mutations is because by introducing genetic diversity, it means you increase the likelihood of survival for that given organism if some catastrophe happens. What do I mean by catastrophe? Some environmental change which now puts a pressure on your survival. Pressure on your survival, that's also called immune pressure. So then you see immune pressure was placed on the virus. It was a pressure on a virus survival. There's mutations happening in a virus all the time. In fact, it's one of those organisms that can introduce mutations rapidly. Why? Because there's so many copies of it made. So the more copies are made, then more easily you can find new mutations. And when there is an immune pressure or any environmental pressure on your survival, that's the conditions that now allow certain mutations to be selected. It's a selection process. By selected means that particular mutation gives the virus now greater chance of survival, this pressure. And then therefore you will see that mutation be retained in a population, and voila, you now have a new variant.
And so we should clarify, because I think we talked about this last year when we met, but mutations, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, mutations aren't purposeful. These are just like accidents, I guess. But so when all these different mutations happen, naturally one comes out that is better at surviving whatever's attacking the virus. You know, you mentioned there's a pressure on it. So the one that just happens to be better for survival is the one that will dominate because it survives more.
Correct, provided that there is an environmental pressure. If there isn't and the mutation is around and there is no pressure to select it, then you can easily have that mutation not have much of an effect. So there has to be that environmental pressure as to why that mutation could come into dominance.
That makes complete sense. For example, and I'm exaggerating for effect here, but let's say if we were shooting them with machine guns and one of them had a mutation with a bulletproof vest, it's going to survive. But if nobody's shooting at them and this mutation with a bulletproof vest came along, it's of no benefit. And in fact, if anything, it's heavier, makes you hotter. You may not even survive. It's the environmental pressure that selects it.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great analogy. I wish I had your talent, actually. I was thinking analogies like that. I don't. I'm a scientist. Oh, well. But yeah, that's a good comparison. Now, substitute bullets for the word antibodies.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah. And now if there's antibodies around, the one that has protection against them will naturally survive far better.
That's right. And that's exactly what happened with the Omicron. Omicron is the first example, as far as I understand, where we definitively see an immune escape virus present itself under the conditions where this happened during an active pandemic as well. Because in theory, we're still in a pandemic. And I know it doesn't feel like that, which is great. We want that, right? We want no one to be suffering. But in theory, we're still in a pandemic because the virus is still around and it's still evolving and it's still creating waves and it's still creating new variants.
Okay. And that, you know, and it's interesting. I did a little checking before the episode just to see. And I know I know people that work at one of the hospitals here in Edmonton. And so I ask whenever, you know, what's the ward called where the really sick go? I forget where they put them in the, I forget the word now, but, you know, intensive care.
Mm, yes.
And so every time I see them, I ask where the numbers at. And the numbers are down quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's a good thing. You know, we're all getting some natural immunity. So people aren't getting as sick, I'm assuming maybe some of the weakest. And I don't mean this is going to sound cruel, but some of the weakest maybe are already taken out. And I don't mean it that way. That's a very sad thing. But maybe those are just...
It's sad. Of course, we cannot deny the tragedy, but it also cannot deny the reality that is also what happened. The virus has taken out the weakest elements, which is, of course, your elderly and those with preconditions that made them susceptible to a disease, to COVID-19 disease. Of course, it's sad. There's no denying, no one should ever be denying that we mourn losses, but losses did happen. And then we should always understand who was affected and why. And the reason why we should be looking at this, because it's not always the elderly. You know? It can sometimes be younger people too, and that's, for example, what happened during the Spanish flu pandemic, right? Younger people were more affected, I believe, in that pandemic. And so then you need to know these things and you need to observe these things so we can start elucidating as to why these things happening the way they are.
Okay. Now, I guess coming back to the immune escape, this was seen before in the chickens, is that right? In chickens with Merrick's disease, is that where it was seen before? Or what was the story there?
So that one is, the reason why that one is interesting, yes, indeed, there was immune escape. And immune escape has been observed in many trials and so on. It's one of the biggest problems when you developing a vaccine that you have to face, is that whatever you're developing vaccine against, that vaccine is robust enough that it will not trigger immune escape. And that's one of the biggest challenges that you have to face in developing vaccine. So with Merrick's disease in chicken, what happened there, the chicken were immunized. And what happened is that the virus itself indeed went through evolution, so it mutated. So again, remember, mutations were happening randomly all the time. Same with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. We have literally lots and lots of mutants abound all the time. But the mutant that allowed the virus to then thrive better under the conditions of these immunized chicken became more pathogenic. That's why this particular story is so interesting. So it as a consequence, the virus in a process of mutations became more deadly as well. And it became, this is from memory, but I believe it became more deadly to both the vaccinated and unvaccinated chicken. But the unvaccinated chickens took an even worse beating. So that's the that was the story there. And that was a surprise and normally what happens, you don't see the virus evolve effortlessly towards a more pathogenic state. Yes, it can happen, but if you look at the history of, say, viruses, whether we're dealing with natural infection or post-vaccination efforts, you typically don't see viruses evolve to be more pathogenic. So that one was a surprise, and as a consequence, people have been studying this. What really happened there, and what could be the conditions that could be driving that? And I should have maybe reviewed this in greater detail, but I think the conditions that drove the pathogenicity of the virus were similar to what we are actually seeing with the COVID-19 vaccines, meaning it's vaccines that were not developed to stop infection, and these vaccines were never meant to stop infection. We're hoping they did, and it looked at the beginning of their use as they might. That's why there was really a lot of excitement about these vaccines when they first came out, but they were never designed to stop infection. They were designed to mitigate severe symptoms once a person is infected. Those are very two different things. And if you're using vaccines that not necessarily will prevent infection, and you use them in like a crowded environment like that, you could stimulate the environment for the virus to become more pathogenic. That's what happened in that case.
They were those vaccines were just reducing the symptoms, correct?
Correct. Yeah. Same thing with COVID-19 vaccines. Those vaccines were designed to reduce severe symptoms only.
Now the good news, apparently they don't think this will happen. They think this is unlikely in humans that this will happen.
Correct, because of the fact that the body of evidence, historical evidence, suggests that for the virus to start randomly or start mutating towards pathogenicity and become more deadly is just rare. That doesn't mean it has not happened. We've seen this even with some of the human diseases. We've seen one of HIV variants come out that is now more pathogenic than maybe some of its
starts with an A, antecedents or an A?
Ancestors.
Yes. There we go.
Thank you for planting the A in my head.
That's all I could remember.
So like once, so it can happen. It just happens to be very rare. So then the dogmatic assumption is that likely the virus will evolve to be less pathogenic and just simply become endemic. So it's just kicking around, but it's not really doing much of a damage. But it can kick around, meaning that it still is around and therefore it survives. But it's in a state that it can survive without really doing much of a damage to us. And that's the ideal goal. And as far as I understand, I think this is the desired prevalent thinking amongst scientists and authorities right now, that this is what maybe COVID-19 has, virus that causes COVID-19 has achieved. Whether that's the case or not, we don't know, because that hasn't been proven, but that's the desired hope right now.
Okay, so let's now swing into the cause of immune escape that the scientific community feels is the more likely one, and that's that it evolved in immunocompromised people.
Correct. So when you were using the adjectives more likely or more accurate and versus less accurate, again, I get to think in terms of what we desire more or what we wish more, and not necessarily what is the real cause. We don't know what the real cause of this immune escape has happened, and we need to remain open to the possibility that it could be vaccine-induced. Now, immune escape, we know, can be vaccine-induced. That's very well established as well. Now, it's not like I've read every single paper in the world about this. So I'm telling you what I'm talking about is from my continuous and studying of this material myself. And this is constantly evolving. And there's always gaps in my knowledge. And over time, these gaps get to be filled. And over time, I gain new knowledge. So just please understand that, of course, any type of expert, and I would say that about any expert, if anyone speaks their mind, always accept the possibility that that information could have elements of incorrect information. Just the nature of things. Now, obviously, you try to, as an expert, you try to minimize that to the greatest extent. So my understanding is that vaccine immune escape or vaccine induced immune escape is well documented. It's well understood. It's just we not necessarily have been able to ever document it in humans. So there's that. And that's obviously not a topic of interest at the moment. Why? I don't know. It's maybe because we don't want to attach any negative outcomes to our global selection of choice, which was to use mass vaccination. So maybe we're just simply ignoring that information. Maybe. I don't know. I'm speculating. But it's not an information that is being actively pursued by the scientific community. So there's sparse information with relation to SARS-CoV studies in relation to SARS-CoV-2 and whether vaccination against that virus might have been the triggering factor towards immune escape that we have observed with the virus. So as a consequence, the more preferred narrative is that it's the immunocompromised patients that have led to the immune escape. Now, what's behind that theory and how does it work? The idea here is that as an immunocompromised individual, you don't get to clear the virus as well. As a consequence, you can be infected for far longer periods of time than your average healthy individual, or even just like any individual. Even if, say, you have some preconditions like, say, hypertension, blah, blah, blah. As an immunocompromised individual, you're worse off. And scientific literature seems to support this idea that indeed immunocompromised individuals can be infected much, much longer, sometimes for obscene length of time, like months on end. So that then suggests the possibility, look, the virus clearly has way more time to keep evolving inside that individual and come up with new mutations and therefore thrive in an environment for longer where finally a mutation will be found that will allow the virus to be like, aha, I can finally dodge completely this immune system of this person and I can survive. And then that person passes that along to next person. And here you go. You just selected in a population a new variant that will dominate. So that's the prevailing theory. And there you can see logically to some degree that makes sense. But I would argue against it. So my argument would be, well, it doesn't require immunocompromised individual for random mutations to show up. Random mutations will be showing up at any point. And if you are a person who, for example, got infected and then you get reinfected, you automatically are in some form of a state of, say, immunocompromised situation as well. So you might be mimicking that environment to some degree. And then you have that environment once again where the virus could be attempt to reach that aha moment, I will survive because this mutation allows me. So there's that. And then there's also evidence, and this is my area of interest, genetic sequencing. So this is a topic that I'm very familiar with. If you do what is called deep sequencing, meaning you take the sample, biological sample from a person's throat or nasal cavity, and you sequence for the SARS-CoV-2 genetic virus. If you take that sample and you sequence and you sequence and you sequence again and again and again, you just do it over and over many, 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 many times, eventually you increase the power of what you're looking at so much, you will start looking at very rare mutations within all of the virus sequences that you sequence. Because remember, when you take the sample, it's not just one virus you're sequencing, you're taking a sample of millions of different virus particles, and then you're finding mutations. And what we know is that sometimes you will observe, as a consequence, you will see every single person carries many different variants. It's just one variant is a major variant. So that's the one where the bulk of all virus is represented by this particular mutant. But then, say, a fraction is another mutant. And an even smaller fraction is another mutant of the virus. And another smaller fraction, tiny, tiny, tiny fraction, is some other mutant. And sometimes, if you look at the people you've sequenced, and you find a very, very tiny amount of one virus, almost negligible amount of a mutation, later on, you can see, oh, look, that mutation eventually became dominant and took over the world or that geographical location. So that's what deep sequencing allows you to do. So you can actually see, in theory, every single one of us can be a carrier of many different variants, not just immunocompromised individual.
Well, aren't you just a bundle of good news?
Well, in a way, though, yeah, it's good news because it to some degree, what I'm trying to say is it's irrelevant. We all can be factories for a new variant. So, and why is that good news? Is because it means you don't need to point fingers at anyone. And definitely, if there is one group of people I would hate to be pointing fingers at for some any form of guilt, is immunocompromised individuals who are already suffering and now also attach a label. Well, look, you are driving the pandemic. No, I think it's actually oversimplification by the scientific community. And the reason why I'm brave enough to say that is because I actually think that happens very often. And that's just human nature. We first oversimplify, and then as we gain more knowledge, we are capable of handling more complex theories.
Yeah. And, you know, you make a good point. It's a discussion for another day. We can't go down this rabbit hole today. But this whole thing of blaming that came out, you know, during the pandemic and is still lingering a little bit, you know, that's hopefully there's a learning lesson for all of us in that. But that's another discussion for another
day.
Well,
let me just point out one thing. I think what happened there is actually something very similar to what we might have observed with Marek's disease. Maybe. Now, this is only a suggestion because obviously no one has really studied this, but I think that's we might have observed there something similar in that the virus evolved soon after mass vaccination commenced, and we witnessed the development or the emergence of the Delta variant, and the Delta variant was hitting both vaccinated and unvaccinated people at the time, but unvaccinated people suffered more. And the reason why is because they didn't have the same defenses as vaccinated, which is the antibodies, because many of them have not yet been infected and had natural protection. Now, the Delta wave obviously did a lot of that, and yes, a lot of unvaccinated people perished. And at the same time, this is why it was so easy to think vaccines were working perfectly and the finger pointing started. Until Omicron emerged, and then again, it kind of leveled the plane for everyone. And the point here is that it's always maybe better to withhold finger pointing because things can change rapidly. And then you just simply accept information as is, right? And now we're in a different world.
Yeah. Now, folks, you may hear some background noises from time to time. We are recording today in the beautiful downtown Edmonton Research Park, Science and Research Park, I believe it is called.
Edmonton Research Center?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I think so.
And we're in a cubicle, and there's cubicles around us. You may hear talking for a while there. Things were shaking. There was a vibration. I thought maybe the building was coming down. So you may hear the odd background noise. Okay, well, let's now swing on to the let's continue with the fun and excitement and talk now about Omicron XBB 1.6. That tells me there must be like a million billion variants. We've got a name like XBB 1.6, like so. Let's talk about that because apparently it's more infectious, and it also can cause pink eye. But folks, we are coming to a lot of good news here. We're going to come. I want to talk about a few things, you know, vitamins and that in a bit. But let's talk about XBB 1.6. How it evolved. how it's more infectious, how it, pink eye, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, lead us down the path of that variant.
Okay, so interesting. You were joking with the number of variants, but if you actually look at all of the sequences, because this virus is being isolated from human samples all over the world all the time, and it's being sequenced all the time around the world. And therefore, we continuously are building the data set of this virus, its genetic code. And that's how we track its evolution. And that's how we come up with new names for variants, because we know which mutations now it might be harboring, right? So if you take a look at all of those sequences, literally by now, since the start of pandemic, we probably have witnessed millions of different variants, like in millions, right? What the actual number is probably even greater than that. Basically,
millions, not billions.
Millions.
Oh, thank God.
There probably is a threshold of potentially different billions of variants possible because of the number of combinations. But in essence, basically every single genetic nucleotide along the virus sequence would have been observed to be mutated by now, probably, with the exception of maybe some super conserved ones, like ones that you are never allowed to touch, because if it gets mutated, the virus will instantly like perish, you will not be able to reproduce. But so yeah, there's millions of variants have been identified. XBB 1.6, what X means is that it's a recombinant virus. It means two different viruses, two different variants came together and they recombine, they fuse together. So portion of XBB comes from one variant and portion of XBB comes from another variant. They recombine somewhere in the midst of the spike protein receptor binding domain. Spike protein receptor binding domain is the area of the spike protein that is involved in binding to our receptors, which allows the virus entry into our cells. So that's the XBB one. That's where the X stands for. Now 1.6, that guy likely came out of India. We can only always speculate, because obviously we can only guess this by where we're starting to observe this genetic sequence first. But just because we observed the sequence first, that doesn't mean it was born there. It might have been imported there. So there's always, so we can only speculate the origins of these, but it looks like the XBB 1.6 came from an Indian subcontinent. And indeed, there is some preliminary data that suggests that it now, once again, has the greater propensity to cause pink eye, which we've observed early on with COVID, earlier versions of COVID variants, and then disappeared. So when I say pink eye, this is seen in infants, based on the limited data that I saw, and older children, they're not as susceptible. And maybe this is a good segue as well for vitamin D, because this is why I made that one of the last videos, is precisely because there's also a lot of evidence suggesting that vitamin D can be very helpful in dealing with eye conditions. So conditions of the eye, especially those that are caused due to inflammation. So then the question is, and I don't know what the answer is, could vitamin D treatment help with dealing with a pink eye, with specifically with this variant or not? But the good news is that the variant, yes, it causes pink eye, but it's not like it's any worse in terms of other clinical symptoms than the variants we've been seeing, or it's not like it's more deadly or anything like that. But it is a variant that, and I didn't check the last week, but it was a variant that was starting to dominate in North America. I checked the American CDC data to see which variants are starting to dominate, and this particular one has been on the rise week after week. So it's starting to replace the prior variant that took over North America, which was 1.5. And there's another one that's competing with it. So which one will take over North America? We don't know. It could be this one, XBB 1.6.
Okay. Now, one thing I thought about earlier and I forgot to mention when you were talking about immune escape and possible causes and that. So throughout the world, a lot of people, and I don't, when I say a lot, I'm using that just, I don't know how many, right? But a lot of people, us, for example, we got our first three shots, and then all those things started coming out. We said, that's enough. I'm not getting any more shots. A lot of people aren't getting any more shots. For me, it was very, I've had it twice. Both times, touch wood, was very, very mild, extremely mild. My wife had it a little worse. My son had it a little worse, but nobody really had anything serious. So, you know, and all the things that are coming out, a lot less people are getting boosters and getting shots. And that, will that help reduce future immune escape, or is that just, am I peeing in the wind?
Maybe it will, but that's once we understand what is the immune pressure on the virus.
Right.
So what is the pressure that is constantly pushing the virus to evolve? By evolve, I mean, what is the pressure that selects these new mutations out of the pool of random mutations that are constantly observed in this virus? Why are these specific mutations constantly selected into the forefront, such as, say, XBB 1.6 variant? Why is that variant being currently selected in North America to start taking over, right? And that's, I suppose, unanswered question. But clearly, by pressure is mean, we have to ask ourselves, what threatens the survival of the virus? And antibodies is a very logical option here. So if we are no longer boosting, and we've already have, say, immunological memory to fight this, and keep in mind, we're constantly also are reboosting ourselves naturally every time we are infected as well. So then there's that. But we do know that natural infection does not trigger the same level of antibody build-up response as the vaccines did. So by reducing the amount of antibodies that are now asked to wage the war against the virus, does that mean we are now reducing that pressure against the virus? So don't know, because I don't think anyone is looking at it from that angle. But indeed, maybe what you're theorizing here, what you suggested, maybe that is true. Maybe by actually no longer vaccinating, we are reducing that pressure on the virus. To me, it looks like the virus is now stuck in its own loop. So what I mean by that is, unfortunately, this virus has become one of the most infectious viruses we know of. So we started with a lot less infectious virus, and through these different waves we observed over the last 3 years, the virus has managed to become far more infectious. So what does that mean? It means that anyone can get infected, like, easy now, right? And what does that mean if you get infected? If I get infected, it means I'm going to start producing antibodies, right? So here we are. Virus has now reached a state where it can now trigger its own evolution simply by how infectious it has become. Because that means we are constantly asked for our immune system to now be producing antibodies against it. And now those antibodies are constantly now asking the virus to dodge those antibodies. So it looks like we're stuck in some situation. And how does that come to an end? I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure whether that means our antibodies level has to drop, or the virus eventually becomes less infectious, or maybe it doesn't matter. Except to me, infection is never irrelevant. Every infection leaves forever permanent footprint on your body. And the reason why is because you just have to think of infection equals payment, and it's your biological payment. It's your body has to pay for that infection. It had to pay with its natural resources, and those including use of your immune system, and those resources are finite. Eventually we die, and there's no escape from it, and we die because we run out of our resources eventually, right? And that includes being able to rebuild things in our body, that includes being able to reprocess things, and that includes being able to fight infections. It's just a natural way of these things, how they progress. So I would always want to limit infections if we can.
Well, like I said earlier, you're a bundle of good news.
But wait, eventually, hey, all I mean is,
we all got to go sometime.
We got to go sometimes. And in the meantime, honor your body to the greatest possibility you can.
And that's actually I wanted to interrupt you because now let's swing the conversation around. Let's end on a good note because, you know, honoring your body, staying healthy, eating healthy is very, very important for personal health, mm-hmm. but also the different vitamins and melatonin. So vitamin D, vitamin C, and melatonin. Let's end the podcast with a discussion on these vitamins, how effective they are, how they help. But let's start with, you know, I wasn't planning on talking about that, but you mentioned honoring your body. So carry on with that first, and then let's swing into the vitamins.
So now keep in mind, because this is the one that I'm struggling psychologically in my head, because what does that mean, honoring your body? Of course, what I mean by that in the first place is to improve your standard of healthy living to the greatest degree that you can, that is comfortable to you. But here is the conundrum that I'm also facing myself. This is something I struggle with in my own personal life, is okay, but pleasure is also important, because pleasure is also, from what I'm seeing, pleasure can also be beneficial to your immune system, and vices are pleasurable. So it's like when I say honor your body, it's just, I feel like it's being able to strike a smart balance between living healthfully, which means restrictions, right? But also allowing some vices that give you pleasure, but we know these vices are not going to be too good. So it just means they have to come not frequently. Let's just use a silly example, and let's pretend ice cream is bad for you. Ice cream will be okay for some people. Some people it might be very bad because they can be sensitive. Let's just call it that, right? Then you don't have ice cream every day. You have ice cream, say, like once a week. Oh man, once you have it, it's amazing. You feel great. You did maybe tiny, tiny damage to your body, but your body can handle tiny damage once in a while. No problem, right? It's the repetitive insult to your body that's when we create issues. And what does that mean? Exercise is very big for your immune system, very big. But ironically, it's also how you exercise. If you exercise excessively, you can actually compromise your immune system. If you exercise moderately and you do it frequently, you will improve your system. You know, the stuff we kind of know, you've got to exercise. You eat very well, very healthily. Why? It's because probably in my understanding of things, if there's one element of our lives that can cause the greatest damage to our well-being, it's food. And the reason why is because food can be inflammatory. So an inflammation can be extremely valuable if you have damage in your body that needs to be repaired. That's where inflammation comes in, and it's very, very important, but it's a double-edged sword. Inflammation can also be very destructive in the process as well if you have too much of it. So you can see the logic. If you have excess intake of very damaging inflammatory food, you're going to be causing damage to your body. So that's where the diet comes in. Quality sleep, reduce smoking. These are stuff we always know, we always heard. But here's why I'm telling you why it actually works. You can improve your quality of immune system. And in this moment, I would say it's worth considering this legitimately, every single one of us, precisely because we are still in a pandemic and we still don't know how this pandemic will end. We don't know yet whether the virus will become mild and endemic, which is what we think is happening. But because there's still new variants and new waves popping up, it still could become more pathogenic. And what do you do at that point? You got to rely on your immune system to protect you, including all the milder variants that are infecting us. So this is where honoring your body is, I think, very, very important. So there's that. And then there's the supplements you mentioned. And the three you mentioned is the ones that, well, actually, those are the ones that I've studied and I'm a big fan of. But that's not my expertise. I just simply studied the science behind them. Why am I a big fan? Vitamin D, I became really big one because it modulates your immune system. Of course, it's good for your bones, but in other levels, it can also have a very positive influence on your immune system. So that's really, really great and of interest to me. And we're just talking about how it might even help with pink eye because it might reduce inflammation. Then there's the vitamin C. That one is really cool because it's antioxidant. It means it removes what we call as reactive oxygen species. There's reactive oxygen species and reactive nitrogen species. Basically, these are chemicals that are so reactive. They have the capacity to literally jump into chemical reactions with, like, practically, for sake of, like, exaggeration, I'm going to say anything. So as a consequence, it can do a lot of damage. Now, we can create that, and we can toss these reactive, highly reactive chemicals at something like, say, a virus and whoop its ass. But then if we have a lot of it, then, of course, it can also start causing damage to you. So then vitamin C can literally grab it and prevent it from being able to react with other elements in our body. That's where vitamin C, amongst other benefits, that's where vitamin C comes in, including anti-inflammatory as well. And then melatonin is the one that I actually knew the least about. And when I studied it, I was like,
before really we get into melatonin, And isn't vitamin C good? If you get COVID, it's good throughout the whole process from the beginning right to the end?
So the review I read on it suggests that it could be beneficial at any stage of dealing with the infection. So it could be a good preventatively, of course, we should have healthy levels of these vitamin D. And if you want to know what that is, you really just have to check your blood levels with your family doctor and check where you are. These are important biological measures that can be used for, say, looking at how well you are doing with, say, your bone densities. You want to look at vitamin D for that, for example. So then,
D or C? D?
D.
Okay.
D.
But yeah. C is the one that's good.
That's
throughout.
The one for the. That's the one that's antioxidant, and the reviewers that I studied suggested that it could be good for any stage of infection with the SARS-CoV-2. Now, whether that's clinic proven or not, that's another story. And as far as I understand, no. But the review that I studied suggested that, look, based on the evidence, it looks like it could be good for any level. The nice thing is also with vitamin C, it looks like we can handle very large quantities without any issues. So that's also reassuring. Not all vitamin levels are safe at and monitoring might be important. Vitamin A is an example of that. So we're not talking about vitamin A, but vitamin A would also be an important one to make sure we don't have too low of an amount, but overdosing with vitamin A could be problematic. So that's a good example.
Yeah. So just to reiterate again, we're not experts on the vitamins, but these are vitamin D, vitamin C, and now we'll talk about melatonin. Or did you finish on melatonin?
No, didn't even start.
So basically the point we're making is, you know, within common sense, within reason, these are good things to help your body have to be healthy overall, but a healthy immune system as well.
Correct. Basically, they can help. And of course, when I mention when we mention vitamin D, vitamin C, you know, there is also another complexity added to that, in that there is different metabolite versions of it, and some of these work much, much better than the other. So there's that taken into consideration. So if you take the basic vitamin D, it has to go through quite a process in your body before you hit the metabolite that is the most effective and most useful for you, and which means you could either be very patient and take lots of vitamin D level, or you could just simply supplement with a metabolite that is already converted to that other version. So there's that. And all of this means, you know, you should be doing this ideally with an oversight of an either expert nutritionist in that specific area or your family doctor. As I mentioned, some of these you can have your blood levels checked to make sure it's always valuable to make sure these vitamins are not below the normal physiological levels, because if there's one thing that I can definitely take out from the studies that I've been looking at, is that being deficient in these vitamins is not good for you. you increase the likelihood of experiencing numerous different diseases, including infections.
Okay. All right. Did you want to comment on melatonin?
Yeah, melatonin is a super interesting molecule that I'm being quite infatuated with right now. Now, keep in mind, melatonin can also have side effects as well. And that one of the ones that people commented on the YouTube channel is sleep disturbances, such as, say, propensity to experiencing nightmares. So, you know, not maybe for everyone.
Oh, with melatonin? Yeah. And yet melatonin is supposed to help you sleep.
That's right. But I don't know how real it is. This is a commentary from people. It's like, hey, just keep in mind that it might give you nightmares.
It's just that the anecdotal evidence stage really
right. Yeah, that's exactly it, right? But so that means it's like, hey, don't just because I mentioned melatonin, it's just like, yeah, jump on melatonin. It's always worthwhile checking this information. But the reason why I'm so interested with melatonin is because it's one of those molecules that really help to maintain proper function of mitochondria. Now, mitochondria are these tiny little factories found in practically all of your cells that produce these molecules that you can think of like batteries for your cell. And so these molecules trap energy, just like batteries, let's say, have energy so that you can use that energy to power up, say, the microphone I'm using. I'm not sure if that's the case, but that's, you know, that's for an example.
It is battery powered today.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go, right? So then we can create molecules called ATP that actually carry energy, and it's the mitochondria, these tiny little factories of power factories in our cells that will produce these. And disrupting proper function of these factories, these mitochondria, can be also quite detrimental. And definitely SARS-CoV-2 virus does a number on mitochondria for sure. It does perturb their proper function, and melatonin comes in helping to preserve that function. So that's another really, really cool power molecule. Another one is melatonin apparently has been found present in all organisms ever studied.
Oh, wow.
That's really interesting. Cellular organisms, I believe. Okay, so it's a universal, omnipresent molecule.
Now, I'm going to stretch back a long ways here to my days in university. That's a lot of years ago, but I'm taking a wild guess here. You said ATP. Is that adenosine triphosphate or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Really? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Bonus points. Wow.
Big time. Way to go. I can't believe you remember a chemical name, but that's, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That's going back a lot of years. Okay. Well, that's cool. So that's basically all the questions I had for you today. So is there, again, at the end of the show, I'll open up the floor. Is there anything you wanted to add? Anything I haven't asked you? Something you want to throw in?
No, I honestly, from my point of view, what is most valuable for me, for viewers to hear, that what will stoke my ego the most? And that's to propagate that message that I actually think is most valuable, which is, again, take care of your immune system to the greatest effect possible, you know, without costing yourself happiness, obviously, and that's honoring your body. So right now, start thinking, well, how can I improve it? And improve it in like the smallest way possible. So I am addicted to many vices. So I'll give you an example, chips. And I just simply buy less of them. But I love them. I can't help myself, right? So that's just an example. So am I still injuring my body with junk food? Yes, I do. I just simply reduce the quantity of it. I started doing, silly exercises, meaning like I exercise for 5 minutes, but I do, and I try to do it for every day. Maybe it does nothing, but I'm trying to, like, I'll just give you an example of what I'm doing. So the biggest message is try, because right now we are in the stage of pandemic that might seem everything is okay, but we never know what still might happen. And one thing that I did not like about this XBB 1.6 that we mentioned earlier is exactly the pink eye. Why are we seeing pink eye again? And which the symptom that disappeared from from variants. It was present first at the start of the pandemic, then it disappeared with later variants, and now it's coming back. And it's so does that mean the virus is finding ways to be more pathogenic down the road? Like, is this one of the, like, a symptom of that? So what can we do? Not much. Any one of us can be infected. So let's just protect our immune system in the best way possible. So the next day, do the healthy living. And one other area that I also promote is get out into nature as much as possible. There is body of evidence from scientific literature that nature exposure acts very beneficial to us as well. And it's very therapeutic. And then you're also in the sun, you're getting your vitamin D. And so that's another one that I would mention. So if there is one benefit that I wish I could inspire people, is to maybe try just a tiny bit more while not removing vices, because that's the irony. Why do we do them? It's because they bring pleasure. And pleasure also, I think, is beneficial to our immune system. So that's probably would be my main message.
Okay, well, that's a great way to end it. And, you know, these kind of things can always sound alarming and such. But, you know, I mean, we've been through how many viruses in human history, and there's many more to come yet. We get through one, we get through them all. We're learning as we go. You know, most likely things will be fine, but you always want to be careful. Be healthy. Everything in moderation, even ice cream and chips, you know. Everything in moderation. Get out and enjoy the sunshine. And you mentioned exercise earlier. Be, you know, good exercise. Like, thank goodness I never liked running. I hate running. I tried and I just can't run. So I swim, I cycle, I scuba dive, nice. Curling. I do a lot of exercises. But, you know, now at my age, some of my friends are starting to get hip and knee replacements, and my hip and knees are still great. So it's like some of my friends who did a lot of running, like they were, I wouldn't call them professional, but they love to run. They ran and ran and ran. They're getting knees, they're getting hips. So it's. Am I saying don't run? No, that's. I'm not saying that. I'm saying everything in moderation. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So let's leave it at that, because we could rattle on for hours about that.
Yeah.
All right, Dr. Rajic, thank you very much. So again, my guest today is Dr. Mikolaj Rajic with Merogenomics, and we'll put links to his company, put links to his YouTube channel in the notes there. Folks, you've been listening to The Fact of the Matter. Bye for now.